We've all had fierce and formidable women in our lives who have shaped who we are now. The Tech and Learning's Honor Roll podcast is dedicated to celebrating women who have shaped the education landscape more than you can possibly imagine. Who better to host this conversation than Drs. Keisha Ray and Frances Gibson, two fierce and formidable women who have been driving innovation in the field of the education world for more than 30 years. Please welcome our hosts, Drs. Keisha Ray and Frances Gibson.
Welcome to episode number 43 of Tech and Learning's Honor Roll, a podcast that celebrates fierce and formidable women in education. I'm Keisha Ray.
And I'm Frances Gibson, and we're here together to help you find another impactful virtual mentor as we join up with another fierce female with a journey like no other. And joining us, Keisha, is someone I'm very proud to call my provost. So let's learn a little bit more about Dr. Easton. Patricia Easton is the Executive Vice President and Provost at Claremont Graduate University, my alma mater, where my heart and mind is. And as a professor and researcher, she specializes in the history of modern philosophy. Her interests include the philosophy of the mind, the history of science, and the history of philosophy. I definitely want to get into her mind today. You know, Easton teaches courses and seminars in early modern philosophy, as well as transdisciplinary courses. She received her BA in psychology and philosophy from Glendon College, York University, and her MA and PhD in philosophy from the University of Western Ontario. It's no surprise, but she has received numerous awards from the Getty Foundation, the CGS Ford Foundation, the Mellon Foundation, among many others that we would not have enough time for on this podcast. She has taught and mentored mostly graduate students for over 30 years, and has been a higher education leader for over 20 years. She has held various administrative positions, such as the Dean of the School of Arts and Humanity, the Associate Provost for Academic Planning, the Vice President of Student and Enrollment Services, and her current position as Provost since 2017. And in 2023, we're also going to have the honor of letting her rest a little bit to go on sabbatical so that we can read what she produces next and what she will be bringing to the classroom for us. So, Keisha, please meet my amazing provost and introduce her to this virtual community.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you so much for being part of our show today. It is incredible. When Frances told me you were a philosopher, I was like, I have so many questions. So many questions that I need answers for. She's like, now. Come on, keep it to the script. So as you probably know, we focus on what we refer to as a pattern of M, and we ask our guests who their mentors are and how they impacted your life. Then we talk about role models and when you look in the mirror. So if you are ready, we will move into the M's. But I think, Frances, you have one little thing you've got to clear up for us.
Of course I do, Keisha. We do this great thing in education called edubabbling, right? Where we like make up new words, or there's words that kind of sound familiar, or we have acronyms or initializing. And so I want to make sure that our listening community is really connected with something that I emphasize, and I know CGU emphasizes, and you actually teach, which is transdisciplinary thinking. So Dr. Easton, welcome to the show. Tell us a little bit more. What is this thing called transdisciplinary thinking? So we set off on the right course with making sure our learning community is connected.
Well, thank you both. It's such a pleasure to be here. And thank you for that question. This has been an intellectual passion of mine for most of my career. Coming to CGU back in 1995, it was called interdisciplinary. And I thought I understood what that was when I did early modern studies. But then the university sort of embarked upon a whole process of thinking about creating this transdisciplinary program. One of our trustees, actually, from the sciences, was the one who said, look, we have to bring multiple disciplines together to solve problems. So there is a local, national, and a global debate around what transdisciplinarity is. But let me just say that the CGU version of it is to take really wicked, difficult, complex problems and bring anybody to the table who has something to offer. And in addition, the methodology is, once you bring all of these different perspectives to the table around a problem, you have to create a new discourse, because you have to bring those ideas together and you have to synthesize them. And so part of the transdisciplinary ideal is not just to bring people together to solve a problem, but to really create a new way of thinking and a new way of talking about the problem that really leads to better solutions.
You know, as you were describing that, which I, my years in higher education, we did refer to it as interdisciplinary, but in, when you were giving the explanation, what came to my mind was inclusive, because I can remember being at, you know, Faculty Senate and having things come up and we're like, oh, I mean, that's not really your college. So you just stay right over there in your little corner. And when we're ready for you to pipe in on your 10 cents worth, we'll let you know. And this sounds 1,000 times more inclusive, especially if you think about the wicked complex problems. I love that term too, that universities are having to face today with the student populations that we are inviting in and the just empowerment that we're giving students that we never did. You know, I was in the early 90s. We're like, oh, no, we're not going to, you know we told you we were going to try to enlighten you, but only this much and only when we want you to be enlightened. That's right. This is how you do it. So, but now it's like fair game for everybody. And I love that. I wish I was back on a campus today. But it is, it would be super cool to be a fly on the wall during some of those conversations, I bet, especially as the disciplines start really, you know, staking their territory.
That's why I've really stayed my whole career at Claremont Graduate University, because of its scale. It allows you to break down those silos and really have conversations that are meaningful.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I was at Vanderbilt and Johns Hopkins, and I think each of them could benefit from some of that conversation. And they may be having it today. It wasn't happening in the 90s. All right, my friend, are you ready for the M's?
Yes, I am.
All right. Can you share with us who your role models are and why?
There's so many people that have impacted my life and that I have learned from and followed from. Some of them in novels, right? Some of them in philosophy books. Some of them in real time. And who do you pick out of that, you know, role model? I mean, certainly from the perspective of, you know, becoming a philosopher, I have my favorite philosophers. So I think about, what would Aristotle say, or what would Descartes say? I'm a historian of philosophy. So certainly they have been role models for me in my philosophical thinking. And even though I'm close to LA, I'm really not a celebrity person. So, you know, I don't think about, think about role models as people I see on the screen either. But if I were to try to name the kind of people who I think really face the world with courage and resolve and resilience, those are the people I look for. And who comes to mind? Like Helen Keller, Rosa Parks, Mandela, Marie Curie. So many people have stood, against a great deal of adversity, and those are the people I look to for inspiration.
I'm thinking if you could put together, they always talk about that imaginary dinner list and who you'd want to have at the table, that would be the all-time Shiro group. And of course, we'll allow Aristotle to come in as well. But wow, what a guest list that would be, again, around courage, resolve, and resilience. I love that. You know, you've identified already an iconic list of role models. Who might be some of those iconic mentors in your life? Like, who has really influenced you in real time right now?
Yeah, that's another great question. Of course, on the academic journey, which for me, you know, I'm first generation. My parents didn't go to university. No one in my family went to university. My older sister did. She was the first one. And so my professors were really important to me in that kind of really formative moment. And as an undergraduate, Anne McKenzie, she was a philosophy professor, one of the few women in philosophy at the time. And she really mentored me. And I've kept in touch with her. She really went way beyond the call of duty. And then when I went to graduate school, my mentor there was, you know, Tom Lennon. He, right from my master's level, right all the way through my PhD, he was amazing and opened up opportunities for me to study in France and work at the Bibliothèque Nationale. And it was just, again, it just a worldview changing kind of mentorship. And then, of course, I think like everyone, often our mentors are our family and our friends. You know, when stuff happens, they're the people you go to and you get the advice from. So I definitely give a lot of credit to my close friends and family as well.
You know, when you think about being mentored by those incredible people and the journey that your career has taken, when can you imagine looking into the mirror and recognizing that you were going to be a leader or that you already were a leader?
Confession, I've never seen myself as a leader.
We see you as one. We see you.
I have obviously taken on leadership positions and, you know, even from a young age, starting in sports, you know, I joined the basketball team. Next thing you know, they're voting me as a captain. I joined the volleyball team. Next thing you know, I joined the Fast-O-Matics team. And believe me, that was eighth grade. I was not good in mathematics, but I was the team leader because I could get everybody else to perform. And so looking back, of course, sort of the retrospective mirror, I think there were many moments, you know, where it kind of almost, you know, surprised me that I was finding myself in these positions, but also really enjoying it. Again, I think even in higher education, I did not do a PhD in philosophy to become a provost. I didn't even know what a provost was, I'm sure, when I was doing my PhD. So I've never really sought out deliberately leadership positions. They've been very situational for me. And I don't see that in a bad way. It's been wonderful. I've learned so much along the way and don't regret doing any of it. But seeing myself as a leader, still don't look in the mirror and say, you're a leader. That does not define me. And I'm always surprised or laugh when people ask me those sorts of questions.
Keisha, do you see how humble she is? She is so graceful and leads with so much integrity. I love that you said you can get everyone to perform. I would like everyone to have a performance listening to this podcast, to see your heart and mind and how all of that's connected. You know, when Keisha and I first started this podcast, part of it was that we found like our education, fierce females have not really had this like authentic space to also tell an incredibly personal story. Like we have to put on like, I'm the strong leader. Here's what we're doing. Here's our metrics. Here's my resume and Vita. And this, what you're really unfolding for us is really that personal journey of what leadership is and all the different ways that we might title it, whether it's others finding us and asking us to lead or as my superintendent used to say, you're a leader, whether you like it or not, because folks are watching you and they want to learn from you. And so many watch and learn from you in this space because you do it with so much integrity and with incredible scholarship. So as you think about yourself as a leader, you got to own it, Patricia, because that's who you are. And all these amazing mentors and leaders, there was a clear pattern of female energy there, right? So how do you see women changing the world? And of course, you're included in that.
I think women are changing the world every second of the day. It's incredible. You know, and again, taking a global perspective and a local perspective on this, I think there are many ways in which women have been disadvantaged through the ages in terms of, you know, we're 50% of the population, and yet have been in so many ways not afforded the same opportunities as the other half. And so I think that's real, and I think we have to own that. At the same time, you know, women are, again, quietly changing the world in most instances, because they, again, I don't want to stereotype. I think there's a lot of diversity in how women lead and how they see themselves. But I just think that there's so many examples looking back in time and looking in the present of women who've really made a difference and have done it and have often done so from behind, right? I'm thinking of Michelle Obama. I'm thinking Hillary Clinton. I'm thinking, well, if you even think about some of the women who changed the world, I'm thinking more politics here because the examples are easier to sort of digest. But Margaret Thatcher in the 1980s, like what she did or not, was an incredible trailblazer. Angela Merkel, I'm a big fan of hers and the things that she's done in the time in office. There are philosophers, women, who often aren't read, and yet when you pick them up and start to read them, they have so much to offer, and often things to offer that others in their time did not have to offer. And there I'm thinking about Mary Wollstonecraft. I mean, I love Jane Austen as a writer. Simone de Beauvoir. So there's just a lot of women, I think, who have really showed their intelligence and their courage, and they've changed the world, but often from a disadvantaged point of view. And I think that's pretty incredible.
You know, and part of changing the world is disrupting it, right? And really kind of saying, we're not going to go in this direction, we're going to go in this one, or have you considered this? And I see, I mean, Frances was a disruptor in the LA system when she was there, because things that needed to be done just absolutely weren't being done. And Frances is like, no, this has to take place. This has to happen. And here's how we're going to do it. Or she would diplomatically put a team together and let them figure it out, but monitor that team very closely to make sure they were staying on the trajectory that she expected. And then, you know, I mention Jill Biden a lot because, one, I've met her, and I've kind of respect the position that she's taken, especially when she was first named First Lady and they didn't acknowledge her as doctor. And she was like, oh, no. No, no. So how can you think of some female mavericks that are kind of disrupting the system today in all the fields?
That's another, you know, again, examples that would be meaningful to you and the audience as well as me. I guess I want to go back to Angela Merkel just because I really followed her political decision making and, you know, how controversial, how, you know, how she really led at a time where there was a vacuum in Europe. And she took a lot of hits, you know, for some of the things that she, some of the decisions that she and her cabinet made around immigration, around refugees. And yet I think she pulled them through it and they were better for it. And so certainly it takes a lot of courage in today's world to be a political disruptor. And again, she did it with a lot of grace and just, you know, she didn't have to blow up the world to make a difference, right? She really just she followed course, and she followed her sense of what was right. Amanda Gorman, there's a young example of, you know, a poet who seems fearless, right? Just going out there and doing her art, and it gives me a lot of you know, optimism about the future, that we have so many young leaders who are emerging into this space and are willing to challenge the way we think about things and the way the world needs to be. And right now, there's a lot of political discourse that is not being conducted in a way that is going to be very constructive. And I think we really need to empower our next generation to really grapple with some very difficult issues.
Definitely given us some different continuums, whether it's geospatial, across age, across politics, some folks that we can learn from that are, you know, perhaps the folks that put the pebble in the pond and let it disrupt, or really just have explosive moments that we all need to attend to. I love that you brought up Amanda Gorman. Obviously, the teacher in me has been closely watching her work. And Keisha, you might remember one of our guests, Carol Jago, who was on, past president of NCTE, who actually did a lot of writing around the influence of Amanda Gorman. And there was this piece that she wrote, Amanda did, that said, "For there is always light if only we are brave enough to see it. If only we are brave enough to be it." And I think about that in that maverick space of like, who do we need to be? I dare you to care, right? And in doing this caring work, I know we all feel it, especially as the school year is wrapping up, there's this reminder of self-care. So as we're being brave all the time, like, how do we also take care of ourselves? So I'm curious, you're like the EVP, the executive vice president, you're a provost, you teach, you do it all. How do you take care of yourself? What can we learn from Patricia Easton? Because Keisha and I need a better list for self-care.
All right. I hope I have something to offer there. You know, first of all, thank you for that quotation. That's beautiful. What a great sentiment, you know, to bring it in and out, the truth of what needs to happen. That's a beautiful line. I'm going to remember that one. So I'm probably not the best person to ask about self-care in some respects. I do work very, very hard. I do spend a lot of hours. The EVP position is not something that you can do, you know, 40 hours a week. Having said that, even when I was a professor, I was, you know, working a lot of hours as well. So what I do, though, on a daily basis is I walk every day. My husband and I get up early, usually before the sun rises. We do a 40-minute walk. It's a time just to be together, to be quiet, to talk. And so that's been a really great addition to my life in the last probably 6 years that we've been doing that. And I take care of my diet. I try to sleep enough. And then the rest, I hope, takes care of itself. Certainly one of the reasons why I want to step down from this role at this time and go on sabbatical and kind of recharge is precisely because of how much time it requires, and you start to lose your connection to your family and friends because you don't have the time that's necessary to invest in that. So that's self-care, to recognize that that's important to you and that's occasionally you need to step out of the, you know, 24/7 mode and, you know, give yourself some time to think again. Give yourself time to recharge with your relationships in life. So just being aware, I think, being aware of where you are and what you need is, I think, the biggest, recognizing why you're doing what you're doing, that those hours are worth it if you achieve what you're trying to achieve and you understand why you're doing it. So I would say my biggest secret is probably I try to bring self-awareness to every day in my decisions that I'm making.
Self-awareness, one of the strongest social, emotional learning attributes we all need, even as adult learners, right?
It's hard. It's an ongoing effort, right?
Almost nearly impossible, but still possible, right? You know, I'll never forget one of my cognitive coaches, a mentor of mine, much like yourself, like you're sleeping 2-3 hours a day, you're doing everything you can. And she's like, "I'm so worried about you." And I was like, "Stop being worried about me." She said, "You know, I'm not going to worry about you anymore because you're a warrior for kids. Like your sense of purpose becomes so strong." But much like your story, I also knew when I needed to step out, to step back in too. And I remember saying to her, and if this is a gift I can give to you and our audience, I said to her, I wonder if I'm still leading with the same purpose, if I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing, right? And she said to me, "You know, Frances, sometimes a warrior needs to rest to get ready for the next battle, right? So how do you recharge? How do you rejuvenate? How do you study? How do you build new networks so that you can serve in an even greater capacity? So enjoy some of that rest while you also feed your soul.
Thank you. I will. I promise.
It's a deal. I'm going to watch out for you.
And it's hard to know when to say take a sabbatical too. So I applaud you for recognizing that it's time and then kind of leaning into the experience too. Great things happen on long sabbaticals.
I think all leaders need sabbaticals, don't they?
Oh, yeah.
You just do.
Yes. And you know, in higher ed, that's a common practice. In K-12, it's very rare, but just as needed. And I think that's something that, you know, on the K-12 side of the fence, we probably need to push on a little bit more. A district that I led, we did have sabbaticals in contracts, but I think it's super rare to offer those as options in your contracting process.
I think that's the future because, you know, we're looking at the flexibility of the work environment yeah. now, and people were being told that the next generation is saying, I don't want to work overtime, you know, And so I do think that providing more flexible work schedules and also recharging periods, right? Because then you're right. going to have a more productive employee in the long run and a happier one.
Absolutely.
Ooh, disturb the system, ladies. I like
disturbance,
that.
Disturbance. Hey, party of three.
Hey, Keisha and Patricia, did you know this? Like 2 weeks ago, Claremont and Harvard hosted an event based on an AASA article about the state of the superintendency. And one of the advocacy points was sabbaticals for recharging for leaders. So I'm just saying.
Oh, good. Yes.
Keep it going.
Yes. It's a thing. Let's turn it into action.
On that topic, just one little anecdote is I've had this conversation with our board of trustees a few times in open session and in closed session. And, you know, they're kind of amazed that, you know, like sabbaticals are such a, like nobody gets sabbaticals. And I've found myself defending them, you know, in the face of them thinking, well, it's like, you're just going to go travel or, you know, which isn't true. But even if it were true, if that's what makes you better researchers and teachers, then it's a benefit that we should be, you know, investing in for our students. Not just thinking about the one person and they're, you know, they're going off for 6 months. It's really about what is that, what is the purpose of that and how does it serve the educational mission is really the question.
Not that we're going into a rabbit hole, but that can also go to, but I'm going in the rabbit hole, but that can also go to, I worked with a non-traditional program at a university once and we took credit hours that were essentially life experience. And that was, you know, people have had like whole careers and then they're transitioning to another career. And we're like, and you get to start all over with your bachelor's experience, even though you have, you know, and says hopefully no one ever now in the advisor-advisee relationship. But once upon a time, that was a thing. And I think the whole evolution of how we think about education, how we think about experience, how we think about work and kind of what I've done and what I've contributed and how it counts toward my career pathway or even my transcript should really be kind of broadened and explored and in ways that we might have been more nervous about previously. But maybe that's why we had COVID, ladies. Maybe that's the whole purpose of COVID is to make us step out of the bureaucracy and be like, oh, we can do this way. Like I will never go into a grocery store again. I'm just saying. Delivery from here on out. There's no need. That was my learning. That's one of my COVID learnings. I know. I'm a lazy person now. I'm a Wally.
I think those conversations are ongoing. We're having them every day on our campus about competencies and, you know, credentialing and what about, and of course, pre-COVID, it was like, you know, the GRE and the GMAT were necessary.
Yeah.
We had already started to substitute some of that for people's experience if they had been working 5 years. And but it was controversial on our campus because some of the traditional faculty really thought, no, you have to have some kind of standardized testing. COVID has just, that whole debate is done.
We got to make sure we learn from all of this, right?
It's true. All right. Yeah. Speaking of learning, we have a little learning game. It's not really a learning game. It's really more of an insight game that we play to kind of finish off our podcast. And it's a finish this thought. So I'll start, or Frances will start, with a sentence starter, and then you can finish it. And then if you want to elaborate on why you finished it the way you did, you are welcome to do so.
This is Keisha and I pretending that we're Oprah and Gail on the podcast.
It's true. That's BFFs forever, and we're going to go to really nice vacations together. All right. An event that changed my worldview.
Oh, this is like super, super looking inward, but I would say moving to the city was an event that changed my worldview, because I grew up in a very small French-Canadian town, which was lovely. But it was very, isolated, small. And so when I moved to Toronto, it was kind of like, wow. So many different ideas, so many different ways of living, so many different ethnicities. It was really eye-opening for a small town girl. It really opened up my thinking about the world and my small place in it, but that it was really an adventure. Whereas growing up in a small town can be very isolating and very suffocating.
I see an interesting essay or autobiography coming out of that, Dr. Easton. Hey, here's another one. How about this one? I am really curious about this. How about finish this thought? I became a stronger person after.
After I left home at the age of 16. Yes, I went to the big city pretty young.
Why 16? It seems so early.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was a lot of things. Mostly it was a family strife. And for the first year, I stayed in the town. At my best friend's home, her mother said, "Oh, come and live with us," and so tried to work out the issues, the problems, and it wasn't resolving. And so it became really, again, this is in a small town. Maybe this happens everywhere, but I think in cities people don't know and don't care. But everybody had to take a side. It was either my parents were doing something wrong, or I was doing something wrong. And so living under that kind of circumstance, and even my teachers, right? Some of the teachers were like defending me to the death, right? And trying to protect me, but didn't really have all the authority to do that. Because at 16, at least in Ontario at the time, you were a minor. And so you couldn't go on basketball trips. Nobody could sign the form for you. It was like, I was in this holding cell, in this town. And so the law has changed now. You can actually be 16 and take on some of that authority. So it was quite a journey. And so getting out of the small town at 17 was a strong desire.
What big town did you pick?
Toronto.
Oh, yeah. Of course you did.
Yeah, I grew up in a small little town just north of Toronto, so it was the place to go and kind of like get a little bit of anonymity, and be able to explore and become who I wanted to become.
Yeah, that's such a beautiful city too.
Mm-hmm.
All righty, how about this one? My life improved when I
met my future husband. That one's an easy one. And we met actually when I was quite young the first time. So I can't technically at 12, I didn't know that my life was going to change. He was my best friend's older brother. And so I knew him growing up. And then when I went down to the city, he said, here, and so basically we became roommates. And then eventually, back in, I guess it took to about 1992, when we actually became a little bit more than friends. So
nice. Yeah. I think you got big points right there for naming him as your improvement.
Yeah, definitely listen to this on a walk together.
Yes. Yeah. You can even be like, hey, honey, do you want to hear the podcast that I was just interviewed on? Love.
And actually, you know, he makes my very heavy workload possible, I have to say.
Well, we thank him so much too for the partnership and the love leadership that he extends through you in this space and in others. Okay, I have one final one. I got to sneak it in. And it's not your coffee order of the day, but it's this one. A decision that changed your life.
Well, I've already told you my earlier story. So I would say deciding to go to graduate school. Because that is not, you know, where I expected myself to go. And so it was a big decision to, you know, I'm going to go and do a PhD. And again, it was Anne McKenzie. I give her a lot of credit for kind of advising me through that and encouraging me through that and seeing me as somebody who could get a PhD. And then doing the degree, it changed so much about what my future was going to be.
You know, you just spoke about how important it was that you got your PhD, and how brilliant is it that you are now in a space where you can really look through an equity lens and create spaces for so many more folks to receive their PhD. Talk about a full circle journey.
That right there is why I do what I do, just creating those spaces.
Oh my gosh. Well, I feel, Keisha, like, what an opportunity for me to peer into the mind of Dr. Easton. And I know she has shared a story of courage, resilience, and of resolve, and I think love, and also like stepping outside the box and being, you know, unapologetic about, you know, being a maverick. And so while I see her in all these meetings, this poised, professional, graceful person, now I'm able to also say, like, yeah, she's pretty darn fierce too. So I'm curious, what are you learning about the esteemed Patricia Easton?
The esteemed. Well, I'm learning that she is a delightful person. I wish we were neighbors, because I feel like you could take your sabbatical in Nashville. I can make it worth your while. But I, you know, the things that I think one thing is when you said you never saw yourself, I think when you are brave enough to not see yourself, but still do it, you're like, I don't see myself doing this, but I'm still going to do it. That is one of the strongest things I think we can do as humans, is kind of step ahead of where we are and become something we never imagined we could become. And I think the kind of ripple effect that has on your family and your friends, you could never imagine. And just making that decision has changed not only your trajectory of your personal career, but the number of people that you've been able to influence within your life circles. And I think that it is incredible that at the age of 16, you had the wherewithal to get to Toronto, which is honestly ginormous and has very poor traffic flow. And it does. You have to go, you have to experience to know it, but it is not well designed when it comes to getting around, and make your way around that city, and then find yourself in degree programs where you were kind of a first generation in that step, first generation probably to get your PhD, and then move into this higher ed sphere where you are influencing people every single day to pursue higher levels of thinking and problem solving and improving themselves is just a tribute. It really is. And I thank you for doing that work and leading that life. It's amazing. I'm super thankful that you're part of the honor roll.
Well, thank you for that beautiful summary. I'm going to definitely listen to that again. I always love hearing how other people synthesize it's lovely that that you can reflect that back. Thank you.
Well, hey, speaking of reflecting back, if you could reflect back to your 16-year-old self as she's moving into Toronto, what would you tell her?
Do not look back.
Don't question your decisions. Yep. That's awesome.
I love that resolve. Do not look back. You know, Keisha, we always want to continue percolating with these ideas. And this philosopher has definitely given a lot of attention to our thinking and opportunity to spark new thinking. And so I have one of those coaching questions again for our listening audience. And this is in honor of Provost Eason. So here's today's question. You ready, Keisha? It goes like this. How might the life of a philosopher influence your life philosophy? Again, how might the life of a philosopher influence your life philosophy?
Frances is so good at those questions, isn't she? Patricia, we cannot thank you enough for joining us today. Being part of our Honor Roll Circle, Frances and I love the group of women that we have been able to stitch together through their experiences. And they're wide and varied, but they all have three things in common. They're women, they're fierce, and they're formidable. And I am so thankful that you are one of those ladies for us. And to our ladies that are listening, and maybe our men, hopefully we have some men listening to our podcast, I want to remind you to stay tuned and listen to our next podcast, where we're going to highlight another Shero in education and explore their M's. Don't forget to follow our hashtag TL Honor Roll and respond to Frances's coaching question. Check Frances and I out on our social media channels too, and learn a little bit more about us. I'm on LinkedIn. Frances, you're going to have to look for a very long time, but you'll find her somewhere out there mysteriously in the social sphere. And until then,
be fierce
and be formidable.
The Tech and Learning's Honor Roll podcast is produced by Keisha Ray, Frances Gibson, and Christine Weiser. Audio production by Mitchell Tulin and AV Nation. Tech and Learning's Honor Roll theme music is by Madison Van Gundy. Find more episodes on techlearning.com and follow us at hashtag TL Honor Roll. That's TL Honor ROLE.